Welcome to Lost River Legends. Our motto, Ex Tenebris, is Latin for out of the shadows. We attempt to understand the complex world around us and bring light to subjects hidden in darkness. We explore paranormal topics with guests from all around the world. Now welcome your Lost River Legends hosts, James and Brett. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome to the latest episode of Lost River Legends. Our guest today is Andy McGrath of Beasts of Britain. Andy is a cryptozoology enthusiast with over 25 years of research and obsession about the unknown creatures living right under our noses. Andy's focus is on current research and sightings, pictures, videos, and eyewitness accounts of the many cryptids of the British Isles. Andy is also the author of a book called Beasts of Britain. He's a speaker, a field investigator, and he's also currently working on his own TV series. He also hosts his own podcast called Beastly Theories, wherein he features low-key interviews about researchers around the world, also while continuing his passion about writing about cryptids and out-of-place animals in other parts of the world. You can find more information in the show notes about Andy and all his work. We want to thank you for listening to the show, and we hope you enjoy this episode.
Hello, welcome to Lost River Legends. This is your host, James, and I'll be joined today by Andy McGrath. He is from Beasts of Britain. You can find his stuff on YouTube and on Instagram. And Andy's gracious enough to actually join us for a late night chat, a fireside chat, if you will, from a stone's throw away from London. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Thank you for your welcome. Very happy to be here, James.
You know, I came across your work when we first started our Instagram channel. We had very few followers. We were very much into the Bigfoot subject, and you were a quick follow and follow back. And I think you've been following us for a few years now, so we appreciate that. That's actually just I've been able to see the stuff that you're producing and the things that you post, and, you know, vice versa as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm a proud member of Team Followback, by the way. And it's just nice to be online and see people doing it, being interested, being involved. You know, there's so much controversy sometimes, or controversy of opinion in this genre. And it's nice to see people just enjoying it and putting this stuff out there.
Yeah, and for us, it's you know, there's so many curiosities that we have, and Bigfoot being a major proponent of what got us started, what kind of wet our beak, and it's always a subject that has more questions than answers. And, you know, from the perspective of, you know, we always think of the Patty film and California kind of being California and the Midwest being, or sorry, the Northwest being the kind of the center of that. I think we get detracted from the fact that those sightings, there are sightings all over the world, including on your island. Can you tell me how you got into the subject? Because I know that you've been chasing down information on it for some time.
Yeah, no, I have. I got into cryptozoology, I think probably, I always think it's around about the age of 15, but I think it's, I don't know, that sort of early teen period. They were still showing reruns of Arthur C. Clarke's Steelers Universe and the In Search Of program with Leonard Nimoy and other things. And I was just astounded by this Paddy footage and other bits of Loch Ness Monster footage or programs about Ogopogo. another strange animals besides that were out there. And I just started collecting stories, normally things from newspapers, magazines, recordings from television or radio. And then as the internet came in a lot later, you know, sitting on those forums and chat pages and trying to find out bits of information from people. And it was a hobby, just a hobby. I was also, you know, I was a full-time singer, musician for many, many years, and I also worked a long time. And it was just something that was in the background. Now, I came to London to live full-time in 2009. I got married. I had a family. I was working corporate healthcare, 50 hours a week in central London, 3-hour daily commute, you know, and round trip, and hit 40. And, you know, me and my wife, we just decided to do some project, something that we'll enjoy. That we've worked really hard for years and years and years. And she said, what about this monsters thing that you're really into? Why don't you write something about that or make a TV program? And first of all, I actually did write it as a TV pitch. And tried to pitch it to some people and sought some advice from a friend of mine who'd made a few, you know, films. And said, you know, what do you think? And how should I go about this? And he said, you know, I think maybe you should write a book first. And I'd had a similar challenge for another friend who'd asked me laughingly to sort of prove there was more than just Nessie in the British Isles. Oh, you guys just have Nessie. That's all you got. You don't have anything else. Prove it to me. You know, find some sightings. So that was going on too. And I thought, okay, I'll write a book. And like a complete and utter deluded fool who'd never written a book, and so I said, well, I'll just start writing a book then. And almost immediately afterwards, about a month in, I started the page, Beast of Britain. And somebody, a US podcaster, contacted me and said, would you like to interview about this? And so I did an interview and said, yeah, I'm writing this book, Beast of Britain, and it's going to be ready whenever. This is in 2016, and I just started getting lots and lots of these interviews, normally with US podcasts, but also other places like Australia and the UK. And I was sort of releasing blogs along the way as well, parts of chapters of the book, and saying, yeah, it's going to be done, I'm going to write this book. And eventually I did it. It was finished in 2017. And it was an okay first effort. It was all right, but you know, reading it back in 2019, I was like, oh, goodness me, you've got to rewrite this thing. This needs to be better. It's a first effort. You never wrote a book, that's fine. It's on Amazon, it's your own publishing bit. You can just change it. So change it. And I really changed it a lot. And I like how it went. I changed the artwork. I had a great artist called Brett Manning draw some of the creatures based upon eyewitness description. And that really made the book. And she did a map for the front of the book as well, the island, you know, the UK, with some of the creatures on it. And then I started trying to write a book called Beast of North America. And I just couldn't get it right. I did a draft. It was like a couple of hundred pages. And I just chucked it and said, I can't do this. This is rubbish. It's awful. This needs to be something bigger. So I decided, yeah, that is the Beast of North America, South America. That's all part of the series. Let's do an international one. First of all, like a 3-volume series of books that explore, like you've mentioned, you know, things like wild men around the world and like monsters in all these diverse locations. As you say, there really are diverse examples of these creatures all around the world, not just in the USA or the Woodwards in Britain. Let's do a book like that, which I'm halfway through at the moment and really, really flying with it. Should be ready in September. And yeah, I just landed in this place, basically, of being this crypto guy accidentally, just trying to find a hobby after, you know, 8 years of slogging my guts out in central London. And it's mushroomed. I'm not big, I'm not small. Some people know me, some people don't, but it's been nice to have fun and explore this world. And that's where I am now. 3rd version of Beast of Britain coming out. 1st book version of this international cryptid series coming out in September, and just trying to make it interesting.
you know, and chasing your passion and having something that you can have a little bit of an escape with and a little bit of fun with, I think is a healthy thing. You know, part of my journey with that is certainly, you know, that's kind of where that stems from is, you know, my motive is the entertainment factor, the information finding factor. And then, you know, of course, with having a show and reaching out to different people, we make a lot of friends. And that's actually, I feel like I have a lot of friends all over the place that I've never really necessarily met in person, but can reach out to them for questions or for, you know, hey, like your post. I did see that you had made it into the local news there. Is that correct? They reached out to you for commentary?
Oh, yeah. No, I did do quite a few articles. So there was a nice journalist in a tabloid paper, really called The Daily Star. So a really nice guy there. And essentially, he was asking for sightings on tales of different creatures or overviews of different things. And his write-up with them was pretty reasonable considering this is a tabloid newspaper. He more or less kept to the story. It wasn't mocking. And he wanted to do it out of interest, give people something interesting to look at. There's obviously some sensationalism involved in that because they're selling papers, but that's from their side, not mine. So they do that bit. And that was good. And then there's a very popular morning show here called This Morning, which has been running for many, many years on TV. And they've got a funny presenter. She wanted to do a bit about the British Bigfoot. And they kind of prepped me. They said, look, you know, we're going to be having a bit of a laugh at this. So if you're up for it, your game, we'll still let you say your piece and do your serious bit, but we're going to have a little fun. Somebody's going to be in a Bigfoot costume before you get there and prancing around. And there's a lady called Josie. She does these little segments. So it was fine. And I thought, yeah, let's go down. If you can't poke fun at yourself a little bit, actually, it shows sort of an insecurity. If you can and still maintain some sort of semblance of normality, yes, I can have fun with this, but I'm also genuinely interested, then maybe people will, you know, will accept, okay, he seems like a balanced guy. He's looking for something weird in our country that we wouldn't think was here, like the Woodwolves, the Bigfoot, but at the same time, he seems to be pretty reasonable about its possible or impossible presence here in the British Isles.
Yeah, I think that's important that you put yourself out there, especially with the fact that there was a little bit of jovial behavior surrounding it. Some people would be like, you know, if you're going to just make fun of it, I'm not going to show up. You know, you're not taking it seriously. But I think that comes back to, you know, what their ego is on the subject or their what they think they understand. And I think
absolutely.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I jumped on you there. I apologize. I was going to say, but because it's also, it's a big ask. The thing you're asking them to believe is a possibility. That's a big ask for a normie that there's a Loch Ness Monster or a Bigfoot or a Mothman or whatever. It's just, I always say to Eva, because I'm one of these cryptozoologists, I'm very biologically focused. I'm looking for undiscovered animals, not paranormal beings and things like that. So that's my focus with it. I know there's an element to it that people also research from that side, but that's my focus. And I always say to people from the outside, in the genre, who are frustrated with some of the reactions they get from normies or whatever they call them, that you're asking, it's the same thing you're asking them to believe in aliens or ghosts. Think of it that way. You don't think that that's a possibility. That's the same thing. It's the same genre to them. It's all that genre. Aliens, ghosts, paranormal, Bigfoot, Nessie, whatever. It's all the same to somebody outside of the genre. So whatever you find hard to believe yourself as an individual, whenever you're talking to a new person of the genre, imagine that that's the thing you find most difficult is what you're trying to convince them of. Put yourself in their place. And that's why I just try to be balanced. I always say, for some of the parents that we meet in the kids' school, if they ask me about it, I normally say, well, I write about rare animals. And if they prod and poke a bit more, then I'll tell them, and they say, oh, yeah, I have a joke. My wife calls it my big boy's, you know, my grown-up boy's hobby. that kind of thing. And then they can, oh yeah, ha ha ha, I've got one of those grown-up boys' hobbies as well that I enjoy. Sure, I get where you're coming from. We can talk about this a bit. I'm not freaked out. I don't think you need help.
Well, I think that's important to be able to have a conversation about it and about the things you like. You know, I'm looking at this map that you had illustrated, and there's some things on there that I've seen or heard about before. And then there's some that I'm like, wait a minute, I have not heard of this. Particularly the river monster almost looks like it looks like almost like it has like a cubical head to it with multiple tentacles. I'd like to hear kind of some about some of the different things that you've documented that may not be found elsewhere.
Yeah, well, the jelly squid, that's a very, I mean, this is a very, very odd creature, actually. It was spotted near London Bridge in the River Thames. That's the river that's about 100 yards from my house. But this was in the center of London, this part of the river. London Bridge is a very, very busy bridge over the River Thames. There are many, many bridges, but that's a very busy one, very busy walkway, and also this traffic. And a London postman, him and his brother, they were walking over London Bridge in 2014 when they noticed something in the water. They said it was kind of grayish and featureless, slightly elongated square head, around 5 foot in length, as thick as a man's body, but what looked like lots of green tentacles or tassels protruding from the bottom of the head. It was on swimming slowly against the current on the surface of the water, and it kept submerging and resurfacing for about a minute, and then they lost sight of it. It just sank and disappeared. They said it seemed like it was a biological creature. Now, the River Thames does connect to the ocean. It does connect to the English Channel. Whales occasionally get into the River Thames and then get far enough. One was beached on Richmond about 2 months ago. Baby mink whale basically swam up the entire river, and then there's a loch and it's segmented and leveled, and it, bless it, got beached there. It happens all the time. Whales get in. Creatures are seen there from time to time. But what was amazing about this is essentially what would be either a giant squid or a huge jellyfish of an undescribed species. Now, there's lots of possibilities. It could be something else. It could be a box jellyfish covered in silt and mud from the River Thames. Okay, sure. They're not local. Northern Australia, Indo-Pacific region, you know, it'd be very unlikely. Bell jellyfish, they do occasionally get into British waters. I think there was a huge one spotted 2014, 2015, 4 foot across in the River Helford in Cornwall, which is on the far southwest of Britain. But still, again, it's got this pinkish hue. It's quite broad. It doesn't really match the description of this thing. And lastly, there's the possibility that it was some sort of prop or bit of machinery that appeared to be living and was being dragged through the water, perhaps. I mean, it doesn't seem likely. Whatever they saw was unusual enough to make these two guys say, oh my God, what's going on here, and get a bunch of people to come and have a look, which is unheard of in London, especially. You don't grab strangers on the street and ask them to do anything with you. You know? We don't talk to each other. Those are the rules in Britain. So, very interesting. I think it's a very unique sighting.
Yeah, I've not heard of that one. And just even the geometry of the head is like, wait a minute, you know, kind of takes you aback.
It's odd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really cool. And I think about how, you know, we are a seafaring culture, you know, for hundreds of years, but the ocean is just so vast, and there's a lot of us that haven't been on the ocean, you know, and in this case, you know, it went to right near a major population center, you know, so from land looking to water. And we have some of those kind of encounters or sightings, or for lack of a better term, like stuff that washes up over, you know, all around the world. But in the U.S. particularly, there's things like the Montauk Monster is one that's kind of interesting. And there's we see some footage out of parts of Indonesia and Asia that there's some just strange shaped biology out there that washes ashore. We don't know where it comes from or what, you know, where it thrives, that kind of a thing. So it's certainly possible. Our oceans are vastly unexplored to our knowledge, at least.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost, look at our lakes even. There's our lochs and lakes and all around the world. These deep bodies of water, yes, we do have the equipment that could explore much of them, but just the logistics, even with like a good sub, of exploring the entirety of a lake and being a deep lake, I mean, a glacial lake, and being completely sure that you've made a good account of all the animals that may or may not be living in there. Like the recent eDNA study that they did in Loch Ness. Well, you know, then yes, that's very good. eDNA is fantastic, but this is a huge deep body of water. I don't know how many places they sampled. It was 28 or more places. I can't remember what the number was. But they didn't find otters in this eDNA study, and there are otters in Loch Ness. I've seen them. They didn't find catfish. There are catfish by all accounts. They found lots of eels. But wow, there's so many, you would know. There's another fish and even presence of human DNA. And yet, it was excluded, this monster. We didn't find this monster. And nobody said, well, we didn't report seals or otters either. Does that mean there could be something in there that you haven't discovered? I suppose the point I'm trying to make is it's just impossible. You can't explore, even with eDNA, that whole body of water. You just got to, you're taking sort of, what's the word? It's like needle in a haystack, little jabs at the water and saying, okay, that bit there is representative and that bit's representative. But it can never cover the whole line. Just reiterating and supporting your point, there are so many undiscovered places, even within the countries we inhabit that are very well catalogued for wildlife. There's room for things to hide out.
Yeah, and with that, I mean, the parts per million of DNA versus, you know, other inorganic matter in a wow, you know, large loch or lake, it's like, what can you, you know, like you said, it's a very, very small needle in a very, very large haystack.
Yeah, and a huge haystack, 750 feet allegedly more in places of water, a mile wide. It's not very wide, but 25 miles long, not the biggest lake in the world, but deep, so deep. And it's just a strange place. But it to me, it's the frustrating part is the finality of these types of things people do when they did the sonar sweep. I knew a guy who was involved in the first one, Operation Deep Scan, in the 80s, I think it was. And he said, they were so dangerous, all of us sailing our boats across the loch all at once because it has these jagged sides. We couldn't go anywhere near the sides for a start, so we couldn't go in any of the coves or bays. And he said, then the actual sonar we were using was such a blanket, it was cutting everybody else's results out. We had to set it really, really low and sail the lock. So he said it was kind of like a publicity stunt in a way, because we couldn't effectively create a sonar blanket at that time for which to examine the lock. So we did this thing, and it was determined afterwards, yes, we didn't find anything, even though they had two unregistered interesting contacts on the first day. They didn't find anything, but they were never going to. The setup was already wrong. But, you know, what cryptozoology and the media is like, it's about the presentation. The presentation was no success. Again, I don't know if anything is in Loch Ness, but I think we just, there is, there does not exist out there the right the right amount of equipment and will to make a thorough examination of these entire bodies of water or forest or wherever it is. It doesn't exist. We're talking about massive manpower to solve it. And as far as I'm aware, currently nobody's willing to fund that.
For a long time, we only had kind of those old 50s photos of Nessie, and that's actually, we've seen a lot more possible footage and or photos. We also have encounters in other areas of similar shaped creatures, so that actually lends a little bit more credence to it not being a solo thing. You know, it's not just a one-off.
Absolutely. I mean, Loch monster stories throughout Scotland, and there are lake monster stories throughout Wales and England, and even more so than that, there are many sea monster stories. That could be itinerant lake monsters moving between land and between lake and sea around the entire coast of Britain. There are so many of these sightings historically, and then some of them in the more recent past as well, that it beggars belief. When I wrote this book, actually, that was one of the things that really surprised me. Hang along. There's so many coastal sightings here. This is very strange. Now, of course, they're less frequent in one sense because that's more of a transient presence and people are seeing them because they are on the beach or sailing around the coast. When you're in a lake like Loch Ness, for example, sightings are more frequent because of the closed environment, isn't it? Less body of water for it to move about in. But it amazed me. There would be so many. In fact, talking about the River Thames again in 2016, before I decided to write the book, there was another trigger in March and April of that year when Tamsin, the River Thames monster, made an appearance and was filmed three times by three different unconnected individuals over a period of about 3 weeks in the spring of 2016. Once from the Emirates cable car, the big cable car that goes across the river near the Emirates, the O2 Centre in London, and another one near Docklands, and a further one from a pleasure cruise on the Thames, and all film sightings, all unconnected individuals. There's something serpentine, humped, very unusual in the river, and people can go and search online and just River Thames monster, and it'll come up, you'll find it. It was that to me, because I was on the river between the first sighting and the second one. I wasn't around for the third, searching for this thing. It was my first, I suppose, serious attempt to try to find something as it was happening. Quite amazing. These types of things take place all the time in the UK, but of course, you know, it makes newspaper headlines for a few days and then the interest dies away and back to business like anywhere.
That always amazes me how fleeting, you know, news stories are, even if they're a big story. That footage is readily available, easy to find. Just type in Thames River monster. There it is. There's kind of like a dome construction site in the background. Is that what I'm seeing?
Yeah, you can see a construction site in the foreground. I think towards the background is the O2 Centre on the other, the big stadium on the other side of the river. Yeah. I mean, I would estimate at a guess 30, 40 feet plus at least for the length of that thing. You can see the dark shape in the first clip by, I think it's the user was Penplate, who was in the cable car. You can see that darkness beneath the waves as well. Now, whales, as I said, do occasionally get into the river, but you will always know they're there because they get into trouble quite quickly if they get that far in. There hasn't been an instant where we've had a whale in the river and not had to rescue it in some regard, or not, people have not seen it blowing. That wasn't observed at all within this whole 3 week period. There was just a large, dark colored serpentine animal moving about the river. Nobody knew what it was. And then it disappeared. It was never seen again.
Yeah, I like that it's kind of, it's more substantiated when it comes to having, you know, three people at three different times seeing it over.
Yeah.
That to me, it's like, okay, you know, that establishes it more as a thing.
As a something.
Versus, you know, maybe not a figment of imagination, but also the fact that it's captured, right? That we have kind of the three witnesses to it, and then a little piece of evidence there to go off of. So that sturdies up the argument quite a bit that there's something something going on there.
Something going on.
For sure. So your island has quite a history, you know, going back even going back pre-Roman, a little bit of things going on there with the fairy and the fae and kind of that will-o-wisp, will-o-of-the-wisp.
Will-o-of-the-wisp, you're right, yeah.
That ties in directly with just kind of I don't know if that's you know, the energy there that exists there that's always been there, or it has to do with the cultures that have come and migrated and or conquered.
Yeah.
Can you give us a little bit of background on that?
It's not a subject I'm really, really well versed on. I do write a chapter in the book which is called The Little People or the Hairy Fairy Folk, in which I'm basically trying to establish whether some of these little people legends were stories of either pygmy people or perhaps undiscovered small primates, like the Djangadi of Australia, but something similar to, so you've got tales persisted for centuries or longer, the British Isles and the fairies, elves, gnomes, brownies, imps, hobgoblins, pixies, pukas, knockers, venadry, oris, gorgas, bubas, trows. That's just to name a few. And these are all, they're all catalogued under the word fairy. That's just a coverall term that you find in actually a lot of other cultures. This coverall term that shelters, you know, a multitude of beings and encapsulates all of their changeable descriptions and attributes. Often one of the very common descriptions is that they're small in stature, they're elusive, short-tempered, might be magical. Often they will do menial tasks around the house, or historically they would do menial tasks around farms and the house for gifts of porridge or milk and things like that. Something that actually is found in other cultures as well. But it's, you know, it's just really hard to tell what they might be. I had a theory for quite a while, especially some of the more goblin-like ones, like the brownies or the trisicle, or it could be at least a small primate-like creature, similar to the Djangadi, or perhaps the trows in Orkney would be more similar to, I don't know, some sort of proto-pygmy, like the Djangadi of Australia, or the Holder folk of Iceland even, maybe like a little people, in fact. But it's difficult to pin it down, because where these legends exist in the modern day, which is mostly in the Celtic part of the country, where they persist in places like Ireland, and you'll find this, I'm sure, in America as well, both Native American folklores, it's, the story is so wrapped up in spirituality and folklore and tradition that it's hard to extract the true facts and detail from the story, because essentially the people that are telling you the story are believing two contrary things at the same time. One is that it's a real creature, two, that it's a sort of a supernatural creature of some kind instead of a flesh and blood being. And it's hard to really go anywhere with that. I'll tell you what, I'll give you two examples of sightings here, modern day sightings in the UK, that I think are different types of creatures. And one would be these two little golden mane men, and they were spotted in 2018, New Year's Day, in a place called Errington Woods. And a lady was walking her dog, and she saw these two little small, hairy, human-type figures. She'd heard noises before, like chattering noises, almost like a muttering noise. She said it was ape-like, and then she looked into the trees and saw two tawny-colored, hair-covered males, 3 feet tall. She saw the anatomy of one, so she was sure it was a male. She said they looked like small, primitive humans. One was wearing what she could only assume was a loincloth. They each had a mane of hair down their necks. They were muscular. She said they weren't children or young. They were adults. And she looked for a few seconds and got her mobile out, and then her dog started barking, and they disappeared. So that's, to me, yes, there are some primate-like characteristics, but that seems to me like more a proto-pygmy type of creature, a little person, but a little human-type person, not an ape or a primate of any kind. And then there's things like the trolls of Slitting Mill, which, I mean, this is the famous story actually from 1975, and Cannock Chase in the place renowned with lots of different sightings of things, from Bigfoot to werewolves to little people and trolls and UFOs and everything. So it's a strange area anyway. And Slitting Mill, which is very close to there, was the scene of this encounter. So a young couple are driving home. It's the 1970s, 1975. They car stalls on the road, and the husband gets out to try to fix everything. Then the wife sitting in the car sees a strange troll-like creature staring from the bushes that runs across the road and hides at the other side. And she can see there's three of these creatures just staring at them, sort of hooked nose, hunched back, no clothes on, completely hair covered, 4 feet tall, and watching them. And allegedly, by all accounts, they even lost some time. Well, I think they lost some time, this couple. So that, to me, represents more of a, this is more of a primate-like creature, or at least it matches that description. But what to make of it? It's so diverse, and it's so unsubstantiated. What could it possibly be? I think if these sightings are real, if they are true and factual, that they're representative of several different types of little folk in the country that may be living alongside us all, or may now be extinct. And perhaps these are cultural inherited memories that people are having, either through desire or something else.
Yeah, they're common in many different areas of the world, many continents. We actually have talked about the Pryor Mountain little people, which are up in Montana. And then we have Pukwudgies and Menihuni. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of little subspecies, I guess, in the little people class, I guess you would say. But it's interesting, like, how many you listed off, just, you know, the landmass that is Great Britain. I mean, it's a fair, you know, it's got fair diversity, and it's got, you know, as far as the square mileage goes, I think it's comparable to, say, the state of Florida. I think that's about pretty close.
Yeah, I mean, it might even be smaller than something like that. Anyway, I would say to people, it's not small if you're walking. Like, anyway, you know, it's small on a map, perhaps, compared to North America or Russia or someplace like that, but it's not small if you're walking. There was another point you mentioned there about North America, and it got me thinking about something I wrote about in this vision of the book, was this plagiarized paranormal pantheon that you find around the world, actually, with the names of these creatures. So in North America, it was interesting, we find some of the tribes share very similar tales of these folklore creatures, their descriptions and characteristics and their names also plagiarized and personalized in each tribe. Now that's, you know, that's normal if they had some contact with each other over time. So example, you get the variants of the name Bukwas in Pukwas and Pukmis of the Nootka Wakashin and Pukwabis of the Maka Wakashin, and they bear a resemblance to the Algonquin Pukwaji, don't they? And that means the wild man of the woods who vanishes, apparently. Whereas Bukwas, that's derived from a term meaning the wild man of the woods. So that's more or less the same. Then you get the box or pucks of the Belakula, Belishin, and that's got a really striking etymological resemblance to English puck. As you hear in A Midsummer Night's Dream, which is puck, puka, puka, that's in different spellings, that's in all the Celtic spellings, that's, you know, very similar to what we have here. So, and that name exists in Old Norse as Puki, with related forms in the Swedish of Puk, Icelandic Puki, and Frisian Puk. You know, it's almost the same thing. And in Western Europe, you know, it's actually thought to be derived from an Irish source, whereas it's used so frequently, you can actually see it in Irish place names even now. And of course, like we mentioned before, the Celtic languages, Cornish and Welsh, Pukka and Buka. So just the relation between those Celtic names and the Norse names and the Native American names to me was a big hint. Is this that we're all plagiarizing it? Actually, did the Native Americans start describing their little people in terms that some of the first Europeans would have used to describe them so they could communicate with us? And then as time went on, that actually just became their word for it. Is that a possibility? You get that with things like the Duende in South America, where actually, if you look at the sightings, it's Central and South America for variants of the Duende, Spain and Portugal. Well, of course, how could that possibly be other than it's been transferred from Spain and Portugal to South America and Central America during their colonial period? Does that mean that the Central and South Americans are making up the legend, or does it mean that they just over time started using the Spanish word for it to describe it to the colonial inhabitants that took over the land, and then it became their word over time? That's my that kind of stuff that keeps me up at night thinking about this stuff. What could it be?
Certainly. And I think we like to file it away and say, hey, you know, it is this name and it does live here and it does these things and it looks like this. But it, and maybe even that is something that's been around a long time, you know, where those names, you know, didn't fit their common tongue or fit their experience. And so when it was outside of their experience, they had a little bit different naming. But it's interesting though, all that overlap that you're talking about there in the entomology, that's fascinating to me. Like where does that come from?
Where does it come from? And I'm very interested in history as well. So the Duende thing, especially, it just really, really stuck with me. You know, we remember in the early noughties, there were on with YouTube, there was on mid noughties, there was that whole rash of Duende film sightings. Normally there's some kind of kids in Central or South America playing football or messing around outside at night, and then there's a little Duende sighting, right? It was so viral back in those early YouTube days. And I often think, same thing with Bigfoot here in Britain perhaps, is this like a digital folklore of revival that suddenly the internet or television or whatever has come up has made this attractive again? I'm not just that people are faking it for likes and online traction to sell ads and things like that to go viral. But are people is their interest being piqued by this folklore revival that's happening in fairy folklore? It's really happening. Like, fairy tours and fairy whispers are really big at the moment. And people like Irwin Sanders, I don't know if you've seen this guy, British guy, does these fairy films, and they've got this almost meditative ASMR quality with this dubious CGI fairy folk wandering around. They achieve kind of cult status in the latter part of the last decade. People really like him, and it almost makes them overlook his terrible CGI, and they think, well, maybe Irwin is talking to fairies. And there's other guys. I think there's a guy in Ireland, Pat Noon. He's got a farm in Galway, and he does these fairy tours. It's a fairy farm, actually. And you go along and go over the little fairy houses and, you know, the forest and the places where they live, and people, they love it. They just love it, and they go along for it and believe in fairies. And again, I have to ask myself, is it wrong for me to say that that's a little bit crazy? Because I believe there could be a Bigfoot, right? So, or is there a line that we draw at some point and say, no, that's the line, you can't go past that?
Sure. And I think, you know, there's a little bit of like art imitating, you know, stuff that's really going on. There's a tradition, a tradition around it, and kind of that entertainment value that people get out of, you know, they get a little bit of a rise out of the idea that there's these other beings, these other things.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So,
yeah, it could be.
I wanted to address the big cat sightings and kind of preface that with there, you know, back in some of the early days there in Britain, there were quite a few exotic animals being imported and being kept as pets or as guards. And some of those things have, you know, after a certain law was passed, I think it was in the 70s, a lot of people set them loose, you know, and they went out and survived or died or whatever. But to preface that with, some of these big cats that are being seen would not be attributed to that. And I'd like to get into that a little bit with you if you could.
Okay. Well, I mean, the most commonly held theory that the presence of big cats, as you mentioned, is that they were released by exotic pet owners shortly before the introduction of the Dangerous Wild Animals Act 1976. That was introduced to regulate the disquieting trend in the late 60s and early 70s of people keeping dangerous, exotic, and hybrid status animals, you know, in their backyard garden or on their farm or as a guard dog, or even occasionally, you know, people walking down Carnaby Street with lions on a lead and the rest of it. So there was no law to control that, and the British government felt like they had to do something. So they introduced this act, and many parts of it were really financially prohibitive for keeping these animals. So I think it seemed to have had the opposite of the desired effect, keeping the population of them under strict control. So we read, for example, in Section 3, C and F of the Act, there's a requirement, and that any animal concerned at all times of it being kept only under the authority of the license be held in accommodation which secures that the animal will not escape, which is suitable with regards to construction, size, temperature, lighting, ventilation, drainage, cleanliness, and which is suitable for the number of animals proposed to be held in the accommodation. And while any animal concerned that the premises where it will normally be held, its accommodation is such that it can take adequate exercise. Now, if you've got a puma or a cougar, if you like, they'd call it cougar, and a leopard, and you have to build something that can maintain them and give them regular exercise within the enclosure, and they've got drainage and ventilation and lighting and the temperature control, that's so expensive, especially in that time. Before, you just had this great cat that you kept on the proxy and pressure, for instance. Now you've got a big expense. I think, sadly, that it was those two stipulations that led to big cat owners releasing their pets just before this act came into force. Now, the animals that we're seeing now, these are not those animals. This was 1976, 45 years ago. Maybe, you know, they have a maximum of 17 years lifespan. Let's say 13 years for a puma, 17 years for a leopard. So it should be, you know, no doubt in anybody's mind that we are seeing the descendants of these animals, and that they are moving out throughout the country. Of course, they have quite a large territory individually as animals, and they are moving out throughout the country, and sightings literally take place in every single part of Britain. Every single part. Even here, there's sightings within 5 miles of where I live that have been made by people that have no interest in this subject and yet saw something they really, really can't explain, other than to say it was a huge, big cat. And, you know, there we are. You know, it's a crazy subject. I'll tell you about one. I tell a lot of people about this one, actually. There's this local one in Rusper, which is in West Sussex, actually, but it's not far from here. This is in 2017. There was a horse breeder who contacted me, thinking that a big cat was on the loose. And she had gone with a friend in her Land Rover to pick up a hay consignment for her horses. And there's the way it works here sometimes, that there's a farmyard, you have a contract with them, you just drive in and take it. There's nobody there. You just take your hay, load it up, and off you go. So she arrived about 9:30 p.m. at night and had loaded the hay and was literally just about to leave when she saw, illuminated by her headlights, an enormous jet black cat walking towards them, her and a friend, looking at them intently, about 45 feet away. She had stopped and licked its nose before casually disappearing into a hedgerow. Now, her description, it was huge, had big eyes shining back at them. It wasn't bothered by them. She saw it close enough to see that it was male, about the size of a Great Dane, but much, much heavier built, and definitely male. Body about 4 foot long, tail 3 foot long, black. Now, she was a horse breeder, so she said, I'm very good at judging size. I'm good at judging size. I work with animals all the time. It was stocky, it was thick, good boned, and had this slinky walk, you know, that big cat walk, slinky walk for its size. Ears were also strange. They were not pointed, but round. So that's a great tell for me. She's not mistaken some domestic cat at an odd angle. She's not seen perhaps one of these designer Savannah cats in the dark and being spooked out. You know, these F1, F4 Savannah cats, these serval domestic cross that people are very fond of keeping at the moment. She saw a big cat. And there's no other explanation for it. Now, sightings like that, that's just a very regular, normal type of description that happens all over the country. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, they describe a melanistic leopard often, which is quite curious when you think of it. It must have been a popular pet, or something that resembles a puma. And occasionally there are other things like jungle cats and lynx, but they're more rare. And yet, here we are, you know, living with this unacknowledged problem in the UK, and I think it will become a problem, of these predatory large cats spreading out throughout the country, unbeknownst to the British public.
So with that, is there prints? Is there carnage? You know, is there livestock that's been laid to waste? Is there kind of some other bits that go along with that?
I think personally they're largely feeding upon rabbits, which we have almost 40 million, and deer, many invasive deer species, and grouse and game birds and other things. Some sheep, but I'm sure some lambs are taken. But we actually lose about 16,000 sheep a year to dog attacks, just people walking the dogs in these areas. Now, when you think that Britain has 35 million sheep, that's actually not a lot, but still a whole number of those attacks could simply be big cats and farmers not knowing any better, just think, oh, well, here we go. You know, a dog has taken some sheep again. That's just what's happened. Deer are often found, you know, deceased, either killed by a bite to the neck or where the carcass has been picked clean. You know, very, very successful. So quite a few deer have been found up in trees as well, which is very hard for dogs to affect. I think I really, it's my firm belief that this act actually created this issue. And since then, the government has either not been interested or they've let it go so far that now they just have to ignore the problem, because if they address it in any way, then they have to do something about it.
Yeah, and it's hard to know if there's any like interbreeding. Like, for instance, you could crossbreed like a lion and a tiger and have a liger.
Yeah.
Any indication of a mix in these
there
sightings?
There are occasionally some cats that have been seen that appear to be melanistic again, but maybe not as large as a leopard. Occasionally, maybe about 2.5 feet, 3 feet long, that are not designer pets, that are melanistic, and basically just look like a leopard on a smaller scale. Now, that's not as common, but it has been reported. Some with pointier ears than, you wouldn't have pointy ears in a leopard, but some with pointed ears they're also large cats. So that's happened occasionally, but there's very, very little evidence of their presence here. There's plenty of clips and photos, but everything, as you would expect when you've got a big cat in your sight, everything is from a distance on a camera phone or something else. And a big cat from a distance in a field without any landmarks looks pretty much the same as a small cat closer in a field without any landmarks. It's one of those things that stands out to me so often. It's pretty hard to tell what you're looking at unless you get up close.
That's remarkable. I couldn't imagine being out in your field and having something that, you know, that can stalk you basically on your own property.
Yeah.
That would be pretty intimidating. Are there any
people? Go ahead.
Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say people aren't getting attacked, by the way. Some people have been intimidated by them. I forget the name of the forest now. It slips my mind, but there was a group of walkers in some woodland, I think maybe 2-3 years ago, that were stalked and essentially escorted out of an area by a big leopard. And they were shocked with this thing, sort of shattered them in the tree line and walked them out of the woods, basically. And I often wondered if that animal had cubs, because it didn't want to attack them. It simply wanted to get them out of there, and did so really effectively. I don't know. Occasionally people have been chased, people have been intimidated. Nobody has been attacked as a form of predation, I mean, as far as I'm aware.
Is there any paranormal aspects that play in with any of the sightings? Where I think you mentioned earlier with the troll sighting, there was some missing time. There was some other weird stuff going on. Is there any crossover with that?
There is no crossover. Unlike things like the black dog sightings, Black Shook, and the mystery or demon dog sightings that we have a long history of throughout the country, there isn't anything like that at all. It just seems to be a very straightforward case of somebody encounters a large predatory cat in the British countryside is first shocked that there should be such things wandering around, and then shortly after, you know, reports it and isn't believed. Although the police, there's been lots of FOIs, freedom of information requests, where the police regularly produce large reports of sightings in various areas of the UK when requested.
So you mentioned dogman or a kind of werewolf type creature with some more paranormal type accompaniment there. The Hounds of Baskerville comes to mind, but that's not related. That's just a Sherlock Holmes title, correct?
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, that's the famous Sherlock Holmes play, isn't it? In fact, gosh, I think I watched that movie the other day, the Basil Rathbone Sherlock Holmes, of course, the best. I think that was really based upon, it was written to appeal to, you know, to the traditional audience in Britain, because it was a common folklore, this black dog. Werewolves, on the other hand, you know, it does appear here as well, and it is a European phenomenon, you know, one which I think has been strangely transported again to North America and other places. But it's something I find really, really, really hard to believe. There are modern werewolf sightings in Britain. You know, as strange as that might seem, people do report them. I've talked to people that I believe that say that they've seen these things. I think the most one of the most recent sightings, or most recent famous sightings, was in December 2016 in a place called Hull in the north of England, when an alleged werewolf was sighted several times by many different people over several weeks. The first sighting was seen by a woman. She saw this werewolf stood upright one moment, next down on all fours, running like a dog, vaulted 30 feet over to the other side of, they call it the drain, basically this big drainage channel that runs through the central country, and vanished up an embankment into some allotments. Allotments are little sort of gardens. There's areas here in the UK where you can just rent out growing space in something called an allotment. Maybe there's a few thousand people there growing vegetables and things. Anyway, ran off into those allotments. She said it both ran on two legs and all fours, having the qualities of both a human and a wolf. I'm guessing that's the bipedal aspect of humans. Another couple said they saw something tall and hairy eating a dog next to a drainage channel, same drainage channel, that jumped over an 8-foot-high fence with the animal in its mouth, which is interesting. Yet another woman walking a dog spotted this half-dog, half-human. This is all within the same time period, by the way. And I love this aspect of the sighting. She said that her dog adamantly refused to go any further along the path they were walking. It sounds like she's disappointed to me. Like, I want you to walk past this big dog, man. What's wrong with you? Whereas, to me, I think the dog has some sense. And there's yet another sighting that was made by an animal rescue worker. Now, one of the traditional names for this creature is Old Stinker, or the werewolf of Hull. And they're slightly different animals, but there's overlap. So this lady, she was driving through the East Riding village of Halsham, in the same area of Hull, and looked out of her window on the driver's side and saw a beast on all fours. First, she thought it was a fox of some kind, and then it stood up and started walking straight towards her car on two legs. Looked like a big dog. They're probably bigger than her car, but it had a human face. I was covered in cream and grey fur. So there's some amazing sightings in that area. And also here in London, a place called Camberwell, Old Cemetery, which is it's a cemetery that was built in the late 1800s. Now it's still used, it actually is still used, but there's Camberwell New Cemetery as well, so it's not as well frequented. There was a gentleman walking through in 1996 en route to see a friend, and I investigated this cemetery as well. Personally, it's kind of, it's very creepy. All the graves are being overgrown by trees and forests, and it's it's not a place you want to walk through at night, but he was anyway. Who's grabbed by the arm by an especially ground by this large creature with dark fur and a head like a German shepherd, looking at him, slobbering, growling, sniffing his body up and down like a dog. And then, just as quickly as the attack starts, it sprints off on two legs, on its hind legs. And he states, many people might have heard me discuss this before, but he states that he believes he was spared because he suffers from a disease that dogs can smell. Such an odd detail. So odd. Some years later, 2004, two girls are walking past the cemetery when they hear this growling noise and see one of the trees over the fence being shaken violently in the cemetery. And just to reassure your audience that, yes, we do not have any bears. We don't have any animal that can shake a tree in this country. And they both ran away terrified, thinking there was something very, very sinister in the graveyard.
You know, something that usually accompanies dogman sightings here in the U.S. are an insane, I shouldn't say insane. You know, when people have an encounter, there's the feeling of dread. There's a feeling of that they're not going to live through this experience. And a lot of the kind of the profile would be, you know, anywhere between 6 to 9 feet tall, pointy ears, broad shoulders, can move quickly, long claws, long fangs. Does that fit a lot of what is seen there as well? Or is there a little bit of a departure?
No, I think my main difficulty is, are some of these sightings conflated with Bigfoot sightings? Because I think sometimes when people discuss an animal like face, they could be discussing something that looks man-like, but is also an animal like Bigfoot would look in some respects. However, and you see that in the Gemma Wallace sighting, I've always think what she says, it was like a big dog with a human face. Well, is she then describing a Bigfoot, a big hairy creature with a human face? And she just thought it was dog-like because it ran on all fours, perhaps. Maybe that's a possibility. The other people, they tend to have this half-dog, half-human description. And especially with, I suppose, the werewolf of Camberwell, he describes something that he appears to have a head like an Alsatian, like a German shepherd to him, so that, you know, indicates a long snout of some kind. But then it also grabs him, so it must have hands and not paws, which is, there's another strange aspect to that. Although he also mentions that it runs off on its hind legs. I often wonder to myself, does he mean hind legs because it ran off on two legs and he assumed that it was a dog? Or did they look like the hind legs of a dog? It's hard to extrapolate some of the differences in those details. I think many of these sightings, they match the traditional werewolf description. And I wonder if that's folklore replaying again for us. Is this something, once again, we're experiencing a resurgence in because of a reformation of Asian folklore? You know, this has been reimagined subconsciously implanted to public consciousness, popular culture, you know, associated with films, books, and the internet. So even if you look at some of the werewolf ideas that we're familiar with, things based upon Sabine Barr and Gold, the Book of Werewolves, 1865, or when did we first hear werewolves change their form in The Full Moon? That's in Guy Andier's A Werewolf in Paris from 1933. And that's And it's just a very funny trait. You know, even this weakness to silver, that's the Werewolf of London movie from 1941. And that's when we find out that, well, we find out, but we get that idea reinforced that lycanthropy is, it's an infectious disease that spreads through a bite. So, you know, I wonder if we're so wrapped up in this stuff now. Many people that give me sightings, by the way, but not all, do have some interest in the subject. And I have to ask myself, it doesn't exclude the sighting, but does it mean that their interest has molded their interpretation of their experience? Or does it mean that it's made it, created it, almost? Is that a possibility? I don't know.
Yeah, like a hyper-awareness of something, and maybe even a confirmation bias that, you know, if they see something, they draw that conclusion.
Yeah. Like if you're looking, for example, would be you're looking at the water of Loch Ness. It's a windy day, and you're staring and staring and staring at water for a long period of time, and you start to see little bumps and humps and movements and wakes and all kinds of things, right? That's a basic example of the process. You've gone there to look for Nessie, and you're going to start to see some signs. Or, I don't know, it's difficult, James. I mean, what kind of syndrome or symptom could make somebody imagine an actual wolfman? Either it's a blatant lie, or, I don't know, or it's a real experience, which is very possible. There's another aspect to it as well, which is this supernatural metamorphosis. So I wonder sometimes, you know, is it a supernatural manifestation of cult-like or ritual activity in which a physical demonic manifestation is brought into being, or the individual undergoes a trance-like metamorphosis where they believe they've become a wolf and start acting that way? There's that example, very famous example, where, who is it? Is it King? Ah, okay, here it is. So, King Larkin, he's changed into a wolf by Zeus, isn't he? As a punishment for killing and cooking his own son, he attempts to feed to the god as a test of his omniscience, but to see if he can tell. As a punishment, Zeus turns him into a wolf, this werewolf. And there's the young athlete DeMarcus takes place in this Arcadian sacrifice of an adolescent boy, whereas after he tastes the entrails of the boy, he's transformed into a wolf for 9 years. And some of this stuff used to take place in ancient rituals. And is that some inherited memory that we have, or is it a result of some modern day thing that could be happening somewhere? Is it an emanation of some kind? I don't know.
It's a great question. We had Dark Waters on from Louisiana, and he posits that there's some heavy witchcraft that can bring about a dog man or a goat man.
Yeah.
And that those are things that have been had for millennia, you know. So it's interesting to see, it, you know, if there is a correlation to it. There may or may not be. We don't know. And I guess kind of tickles the curiosity for sure.
It really does. Yeah. And there definitely is, you know, a traceable history of that, at least, when the participants take on this emanation of the wolf, or this belief of becoming a wolf. It's part of their rituals. I mean, in ancient tradition anyway, I'm not sure about modern. Yeah, so there's all of that. And then there's other people like Lauren Coleman, Patrick Hook, they write in their Field Guide to Bigfoot, the Mystery Primates, giant monkeys inhabiting temperate regions of Asia, Americas, like the Kraidan, the Big Bok, the Savaje, and the Nashi in South America as well. And I wonder, this has a dog-like or baboon-like face. and pointed ears, this giant monkey that's described. Is this, do we have perhaps a vision of that in our nation? Very rare, nocturnal, rarely seen, that is mistaken as a wolf or dog-like creature. And yet there's some large bipedal, vicious monkey. It's a possibility. So many possibilities.
It's not a one-off either. So, the one subject that we haven't talked too much about, I mean, we kind of did touch on it a little bit at the beginning, is Bigfoot in the UK. Seems to be something that's sparked your interest and kind of, is that your gateway drug, so to speak, into the cryptid paranormal arena?
No, it's not. No, I'm a late monster guy, kind of 100% a late monster guy. And Bigfoot, I actually came to Bigfoot in the UK very, very late. Even I would say that my full interest in the subject actually happened when I started writing the book and searching for these other creatures. And I came across various groups in the UK that were searching actively, and lots of people there had claimed to be witnesses, and it was very interesting to me. And after looking a little bit further into it, I discovered there was this these tales of the wood wolves or green men, these hairy man-like creatures that adorned our cathedrals and our tapestries and noble heraldry in Britain and throughout Europe. That seemed to be these precursors for the Bigfoot, these man-like apes or these hairy Neanderthaloid kind of creatures. And, even if you look at the word woodwars itself, it's derived from the Germanic word woodwas, wudu, that means wood or forest, and was possibly meaning to be alive or living, so living forest or the woods coming alive or something like that. And, it's got this history in things, other mythical entities of Europe, like the satyr and the faun and the ogre and the leshy. And they're similarly described as shy, forest-dwelling, hair-covered beings who occasionally, like many other wild men around the world, carry off the occasional maiden from time to time as well. And, this popularity of this creature that was huge in Europe from the 12th century onwards, where they were depicted, as we said, all over the cathedrals and the tapestries and all these heraldic coats of arms, prominent families. And I thought, well, there's a history for that kind of creature. This is also something that could be related, because it's always club carrying, to perhaps a depiction, a pagan throwback of the god Heracles, this hairy, club-wielding, strong man, perhaps, or perhaps the depiction of Heracles is based upon the woodwolves. Anyway, I started looking for modern sightings. I'm laughing because I'm drawing out the point so horribly. I started looking for modern sightings, and I found so many. I've met so many individuals that have just talked about seeing these creatures. There's one very close to me here, which I talk about all the time. And in fact, I was there at the location just yesterday, which is Box Hill in Surrey, the North Downs in Surrey, this beautiful area of natural beauty. And there's these steps cut in to the hillside there with the elevations about 1,000 feet or just under. And there are these, I suppose, earthen steps cut in to the hillside, hemmed in with wood, and it's a killer walk when you walk up it. But the whole surrounding area is just all countryside and fields, and in fact, will lead right down to the South Downs, right to the coast, all the way. And so somebody's running, some lunatic is running up these steps on a summer's night in 2012 for exercise, if you can believe that. Somebody doesn't want to live. Like, I've walked it. You wouldn't want to run this thing. Anyway, so they're taking a rest like the wood, and they're sitting on the steps near the bottom of the hill, and they hear somebody walking down behind them, thinking it's a dog walker, and that's a very common thing there. They move to the side, the way in which for the person to pass them. Somebody comes. An unsettled feeling comes upon this person, and they're being watched. They turn around, look over their right shoulder, stood about 10 meters back, right-hand side of the steps, was a sort of a brown color with patches of gray, very human face with a flat nose, big jaw, out of proportion to the head, which was domed at the top, the head though is, and I stood on two legs, slightly slumped forward, long arms, and thick, heavy build, like solid muscle. Frightened, the witness who saw it, 6 foot plus, so not huge, but you know, in Bigfoot terms, but big, stood staring for about 30 seconds before turning around and walking off, still watching as it walked away, and leaving a stale farm animal type of smell that lingered. Another key point. The witness apparently had heard wood knocks before, but not known what the significance of that was, but not attached any meaning to it, just thought that people were working in the forest, I guess. And yeah, you know, amazing. An amazing, amazing sighting within the stone's throw of where I live. And yet, within the daytime, they get so, there's so many visitors and tourists in this area. You think, just how could this be possible?
Yeah, and that's, you described some very telltale attributes there. There's some other aspects that people commonly see. You know, they'll see a gray colored skin. They'll see kind of, you know, the characteristic of not having a neck. I think you described that. And then behaviors, you know, throwing pine cones, throwing little rocks. If they make eye contact, that they kind of, they wobble side to side. Is there a commonality there?
I've heard about this sort of rocking in some of the sightings. The wood knocks are actually very rare here in the UK. The rocking, the curiosity has happened from time to time, but they've come in to check people out. But generally, most of the sightings I've heard about, nearly all of the sightings that I can validate that I've heard about, have been accidental. Now, in this instance, I think the creature was making its way late in the evening. It was light because it was summer, but late in the evening, it gets dark about 10 o'clock here in the summer. It was making its way down and took the path of least resistance around the forest, and was surprised suddenly to see somebody sitting on the steps. So decided to wait it out and see what would happen. That's what I think happened there. There is one actually that took place in Bristol. There's a great one by a primate keeper in Scotland I talk about all the time. But there was one in Bristol, in Smitham Hill, and this was with a dog walker, hearing a snap of a twig and sort of becoming uneasy and noticing her dog's getting agitated and running off home. So basically leaving her, walking in this forest. And then she can smell this really foul odor. She becomes aware of soft breathing and panics and decides to run. She trips up, falls over, turns to see who's chasing her, and you see this large, 7-foot-tall, dark brown, hairy ape man. She said it watched her for 20 seconds, just standing about 10 feet away, staring, occasionally tilting its head just to find out what she was. Then it moves off into the forest. That was it. Looked strong, but also seemed quite placid and smart. That was her description of it. But had come in to check her out, essentially. And when she fell, I'm guessing it was wondering, what's up? What are you doing here? what are you doing on the floor? What are you? And just left her. Looked at that nice distance that we like to keep, you know, a few meters, a few good meters, in fact, watching from a distance, seeing what we are.
That's really interesting. And it seems like I would group those more with more of the naturalistic, more of the something other as far as creatures go, but something biological, you know. And the smell,
oh, definitely.
The smell, that's another common common thing, very common thing. So it's interesting, this intersection of commonalities that we have. We have an ocean that separates our cryptids, our creatures, and yet there's so much overlap. And I find it just fascinating that it's almost everywhere, you know. Each region, each culture has their own creatures, but it's fascinating to see the crossover that exists.
Yeah, and they really do, by the way. I mean, literally, in researching and studying for this new book, there seem to be many different types around the world, but generally speaking, as far as I can see, there seem to be three classic types within which there are variations. And at least that's the way I try to classify them. One is this sort of giant man ape, like a Bigfoot. This giant ape man, there will be things like Bigfoot. Or maybe the ape man of Bing McDwee here, the big green man of Bing McDwee. And then there's a Neanderthaloid, like a hominid, a Neanderthal type of creature, like a wild man, which seems to be something like the Amas you get in Russia and the Caucasus, or the Yeren in China, or the Woodwows here, which is seen more as a Neanderthaloid kind of creature, or at least within that classification, as far as I can tell so far. Then there's these mystery primates, which would be things like the Yeti, for example. You know, and that's a very interesting thing to me, actually, that I always thought of the Yeti as a sort of a Bigfoot-like creature. I mean, in the strictest sense, but it seems to be more ape-like, or the skunk ape, for example, would be another good example of a mystery primate instead of a wild man Neanderthal-like creature, or a giant ape man of some kind. So yeah, I mean, just delving into this, I've got pages and pages and pages of just names and identities of creatures around the world. It even seems to be, outside of North America, a much greater diversity of these various wild men around the world.
Yeah, I'm sure we don't have we have a lot of sightings and a lot of recorded, you know, there's the Mogollon monster, there's the Beast of Bray Road, there's the, of course, Patty, you know, it's kind of well known, but there's a lot of in between, you know, the Zubies, the Rougarous, regionally even have a lot of really different variations and aspects that actually differentiate.
Oh, yeah, so many.
They differentiate though from each other.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah, absolutely.
So there's a vast, I guess arrangement of attributes but you know, again, a commonality of being, unidentified, I guess, to the point of how do we classify this? How do we do that? And that's part of the challenge, right? To try to treat seriously and to fit it in, you know?
Listen, I really wanted to, in writing this new thing, I really wanted to just put them in this generalized wild man category. And as I looked more and more into it, I became more frustrated to realize I was going to have to really diving deep on the whole thing. and separate them. And I mean, and even to those several giant man ape, black ape, Neanderthaloid categories, similar to the ones that Jeff Meldrum uses, within those, there's many other categories as well. I just can't go into this. This has to be an overview of the subject, not some, I want to write a book for people that might be interested in the subject, not cryptozoologists themselves, who famously don't buy a lot of books. Their friends give them to them. You know, that's I want it to be generally interesting and not horribly detailed and anal, which I have a habit of getting into, so I'm trying to get away from that. I think it's a fascinating subject, because just looking at the sheer extent of names and types around the entire, in every continent in the world, that it reinforces everything I thought about Bigfoot before, or wild men in this country, and says, okay, this isn't, you know, a North American pop culture phenomenon. And then the Brits and Australians, you know, the people in the Anglosphere holding on to that, saying, yeah, we want a part of that too. With the Woodwards of the Yowie, this is also for China and Central Asia and East Asia and this in Siberia and the Caucasus and South America and India and Africa and everywhere apart from Antarctica, they are in some form or another. And that, to me, really says that these creatures must understand us very well, enough to stay away, to really stay out of our way for most of the time, and occupy the parts of the day or the parts of the country that we don't, you know, in order to survive us.
Yeah, the spectrum that they of the diversity is it's kind of mind boggling, you know, and so it's hard to even try to catalog. But it looks like you've done a great job chasing down that subject there for your island there, including reaching out into the oceans and the skies. So it's super cool that you're pursuing that. You're trying to get after understanding, and of course, the interest that you have, always trying to satisfy that appetite. So I can appreciate that personally. I wanted to give you
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming on the show. I wanted to give you an opportunity to plug your work, where people can find you, and what's the best way of communicating if people desire.
Well, the best place to find me, really, where I'm most active, is on Facebook. Just facebook.com/beastsof. I'm on Instagram and Pinterest, and not Twitter. Won't do that to myself, but you know, all the other places. And there is a website, although it needs updating, but the new version of Beast of Britain will be coming out under Hanger Publishing. It's my publisher knows it. It's Hanger1Publishing.com. And you'll find the book there within the next week or so. There's a whole, I've rewritten the entire thing, added loads more photos, chapters, theories, some of which we talked about tonight, and a great new cover as well. Now it will just be a precursor. Once we get the book right for the final version, that will be a precursor to the international series, volume one of that, which will be ready at the end of September.
Well, you're a very busy man, and I'm happy to see that you're getting after that and reaching some of your personal goals. I can't applaud you enough for chasing that down. And you've got a Redbubble merch store where people can find the Beasts of Britain map with the different cryptids. That's one I want. That's one I need to get for myself. I like that. I love that illustration.
Oh yeah. I like that one. That's a great work by artwork by Brett Manning. I have that on my wall. Obviously, I have it, but I do genuinely, really, really like it as well as another piece of art, because I've been a fan of her art for a while. Yeah, and it's all there. And there's other things as well. You know, there's normal things, mugs and t-shirts and placemats. The British kind of little cup mats if you design them. And if you like them, if it's something that you want, I would say this, and you like it and you want it, please do buy it. That would be great.
Well, we'll be sure to link up your information in our show notes. And that'll allow our audience to reach out to you and consume what you have there for the taking. It's exciting, you know, that people are generating more and more information and cataloging more and more encounters. And it's important. I think it's an important thing that a lot of people, you know, the average person doesn't think about, but people that are interested certainly are getting more at their fingertips.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it is, it's growing. It's really growing. And I say to everybody, get out there, investigate the woods, the lakes, anywhere you want to go. Of course, yeah, bears and big cats and the rest of it. Take a friend or somebody know where you're going. But yeah, get out there and have a look around.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Andy, for coming on the show. I know it's really late there. I'll let you get back to your family and get some rest.
Oh, thank you.
And we'll be in touch.
Thank you, James. Yes, and thank you for having me on. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Lost River Legends. If you enjoyed this episode and you would like to help support the podcast, please share it with others and consider subscribing. Here at Lost River Legends, our primary focus is delivering unique topics, amazing guests, all paired with top-notch production value. The Earth we live on has many hidden secrets, countless paranormal stories, and is filled with amazing, curious humans who are trying to find answers to life's questions. Here at Lost River Legends, we are no different. We believe an active curiosity to the unknown is ingrained in the human experience. We hope you'll join us on our journey to explore the lost legends of the Earth by listening to past and future episodes. Until then, James and I wish you health, happiness, and a curious mind. And remember, the clock of life is ticking away. Don't waste another moment and live your best life.